Hi, and welcome to Rule of Carnage. This is a podcast, a YouTube channel set of videos, where myself, Glenn Ford, a games designer and developer, and this guy, Mike Hutchinson, also games designer and developer, chat about designing better miniatures games.
They're good. I like those. Can we talk about those?
I'm quite the fan. So we'll have a little chat about those. So if you're watching this video, or in fact listening to it as a podcast,
hello.
You have in some way gone through a user interface on your web browser or whatever you use to sort of access it that allowed you to download it and look at it. We're quite sort of familiar with the idea of user interfaces in computer games or computers generally, programs, apps, whatever it is. But tabletop games, miniatures games, have elements of user interface. They have the ways in which your player interacts with the game, the buttons they have to push, the things they have to physically pick up and look at to get the information of your game. And for various reasons, we've been having a little ponder about user interfaces in games. It's quite nice because it sort of relates back to a conversation we just had recently about sort of intrinsic and extrinsic and diegetic and non-diegetic information, because you know, particularly in computer games, the idea of like diegetic user interfaces is quite a big thing. Like when a game manages to do that, it sort of gets shouted about quite a lot.
Yeah, I remember when first playing Dead Space, that was sort of telegraphed quite strongly to me.
Yeah, exactly. And sort of whether the user interface is sort of diegetic in a game like Dead Space or sort of more layered over on top by something more familiar, like, I know, Zelda, where you've got like a little energy bar floating 4.5 feet in front of and to the left of you as you walk around the world, which is a bit. So I think personally that in sort of physical games, there are probably sort of three vague categories of like ways in which players interface with the game, whatever mm-hmm. the game sort of ends up being. There's a sort of a mental set of interfaces, and that sort of are the rules. And I know it's sort of an odd idea that maybe are the rules of the game, or are they the thing that you use to interact with the game? If the rules aren't the game, where is the game sat? But certainly there are certain rules that you give to your players as the tools that they use to poke the rest of the game with. It's sort of like, okay, here's your poking stick, you poke that in and then the rest of the engine will twirl. That rule was kind of a user interface element. Yep. How do you present those and get them across? There are the sort of the tactile bits of the user interface, your tokens, your cards, your dice, all those bits and pieces people are going to pick up at various points and manipulate and move around the tabletop, and obviously the miniatures themselves.
Yeah.
And then there's the sort of the visual part of your interface. How are you going to present the elements on your quick reference tables, the bits on your army sheets? How are you going to motivate people to do what you want them to using some sort of graphic design tricks and bits and pieces?
Oh man, that feels like a lot for 25 minutes. It's dripping with stuff to talk about there.
Yeah, we can always split it into two conversations. You know, we're often doing these things on the fly anyway. So yeah, I mean, starting with the more nebulous one, and I think it is because it's a little bit nebulous, this might be a quick one. Is the
no? I don't think it's quick at all. Like I've talked before about a phenomenal podcast that I really adore and have listened to all the way through twice, called the Design Games Podcast, with Nathan Paletta and the other chap who's on it. And they work in role-playing games where, with the exception of a character sheet and dice, which are your category two and category three, like pretty much all of the interface of a tabletop role-playing game exists in the mental interface. And so they spend just hours talking about a couple of sort of clusters of things. One is the naming of things, because the naming of things does at least two important jobs. One is it sort of structures and creates references in your mind so that you can grab at the material quickly. And if you name things the same way that other people name them, like a to hit role isn't called like an attempt to engage or something. It's just called a to hit role, then you know what it is. And then the second sort of cluster is about like how well they evoke what you're trying to evoke, and therefore how successfully they kind of connect you with the material and the game's meaning and the sort of cinema that it's trying to create. So I think when it comes to rule writing in miniature games, I don't think there's anything really different about it. Like, there's two predominant concerns there, and I think that we probably talked elsewhere about how you approach the sort of naming of rules and the structuring of rules. I think we talked about it a fair bit with A Billion Suns, where and our kind of like mental overhead episode, where every time you call a rule something thematic but different to what it is normally called, you ask the player to invest a little bit of cognitive load. And maybe the payoff's worth it, because maybe you're like, oh, well, instead of victory points, these are credits. And that means something, because this is an economy system. And now I know that credits go up and down, and credits can go into negative, and they're not just victory points, even though they sort of are victory points.
Yeah, I think the one that often gets quoted here is Netrunner, that sort of very unnecessarily names things that have...
Right, yeah, your stack and your library and your something or other, which are like just unnecessary names for discard piles and draw stacks.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, obviously I'm a cheerleader for the idea of innovation in design, but at the same time, as I said a few times, there's a hard limit on how much innovation is a good idea in a game. And if you are going to sort of throw away a level of your innovation budget on like renaming stuff for no discernible reason, it's just stick to the conventions. You know, it is handy. It helps. It's the same reason, like when you play a computer game, it's always WASD to move around. Nobody's doing IJKL or something. It's not that those keys would be like infinitely worse. It's just everyone already has their hand on the WASD keys when they're...
Although interestingly, when you go back and play much older games, you discover that's something that emerged like over time and then got standardized on. Because like, I think I went back and played Doom, and it was like suggesting to me very strongly that the arrow keys were what I used. But I guess eventually people just realized that because most people are right-handed and wanted to use the mouse with the right hand, that actually there was a much better way of doing it.
No, absolutely. Yeah, no, I recently played a sort of a properly old game, and I thought it's going to be the arrow keys. I'll have to go to the arrow keys. And then it was just an insane collection. It was a H, J, K, and U or something to move around. I was just like, what possible reason did you pick these keys to be the movement keys? But yeah, and I think for minis games, there's things like, you know, rounds, turns, phases, you know, these are things that people understand the way they unpack. You're going to sort of, if you block your rules out into those sections, and you do give people like, these are the steps of how you go from wanting to shoot somebody, you know, seeing them, hitting them, wounding them, etc. You're giving people sort of recognizable tropes of the interface that they can easily block into their brain. I think also, as I say, that it helps people if you can sort of block out the bits that you're going to need to do and understand, like to sort of operate in the world, and the bits that the game is going to like do to react to what you do. And I think a little bit of sort of setting out the sort of these are your sort of active agency abilities and rules in some sort of way, and also these are the asymmetrical sort of abilities. These are the things that are yours and nobody else's. It's important to sort of block those out so people know that they're going to be breaking the rules when they use them, and to reference to people what's going on and how they're doing it. And then over here is the bit where this is shared stuff. This is the game reacting, so everybody will share in operating this part of the machine. You don't have to like 100% get this. The other guy will go, oh yeah, fair enough, we're now into the shared moment, we can like work this through together. So yeah, I think certainly sort of, yeah, how you name things, how you structure things, how you lay them out, how you sort of box them off for people to understand which parts of the machine they are, you know, are all parts of sort of building up your user interface in relation to sort of the mental map and the mental picture that people have of the game.
And I think the obviously it super affects how you lay the rule book out, and there's a whole separate conversation about that, which I wish I knew the answer to.
Doing that one often, we're terrified to have the rule book conversation. one day we're going to have to. People keep asking for it.
I will have that conversation when I have written a rule book that I am proud of.
Ah.
I'm proud of my games. I've not yet been proud of a rule book.
No, yeah, very rare game designer that is. Sorry, go on. Where were you? What you said?
I was going to say that there's a very, in my mind, there's a very strong relationship as well. Or I am very thoughtful about the relationship between the mental interface, the sort of, you know, the in-brain user interface, and what I provide on the visual interfaces, the bits of card and the quick reference tables and so forth. Because I think that too many games provide a user interface which hasn't really understood their mental interface well enough, or rather the limitations of their mental interface. And I think one thing that is fairly common in war games, particularly because of their complexity, is that they basically assume you to learn by rote a sort of 60-page manual, you know, ignoring all of the special powers for units or whatever. But like asking a player to learn all of the rules is basically asking them to flip through the rule book at the table, unless you provide a very thoughtful quick reference card that sort of tries to point to all the things that you expect are either too fiddly to remember, too odd or unexpected, or just absolutely like essential. And so you just want to lay them out to make sure that everyone remembers that shooting comes before magic, or is it the other way around?
Mm.
And so I think that like understanding your mental interface and thinking about it carefully can really help you when it comes to the visual interfaces and thinking which ones I need to provide or where are players likely to get stuck.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do think sometimes you turn to the quick reference sheet and what you've got there is the rules printed really, really small. and maybe 60% of them cut out, and then you're just like, this is just there's like four pages of quick reference here, dude. This is not
I'm a big fan of the Esoteric Order of Gamers board game quick reference sheets. So I quite often open a board game and get my like designed by Peter rules thing out, and I'm like, oh, thank goodness I don't have to open the rule book because I've got it all on these two sheets of paper. I think and I'm actually pleased by those. I think I'm much more frustrated when I turn to the back page of a rule book and I find a quick reference that basically just gives me the outline of the turn structure and that's it. It's like, that's not enough. I don't know your game yet. Like, give me more. Because also, like, that first act of like flipping to the contents page, flipping through a couple of the rules, looking at the back, like, that's also a way of the game telling me, like, here are the things that are important and you better go and learn. So yeah.
Yeah, and I think there are some obvious things probably I would say to include in your quick reference sheet area. Regularly used tables, lookup tables, things of that nature. They're things that people are not going to lock into their brain. I think a bit of honesty with yourself about which of your mechanics are just lifted from the standard tropes of the game, you know, and you can probably sort of shorthand those, and then like, okay, and then which of my things are requiring people to remember a bunch of numbers, or remember, particularly if you're going with like polynomial dice, reminding people of which dice they're meant to be using at which moment is a big thing. If you're doing things like switching between highest dice out of a pool and cumulative dice on a roll, you know, mechanics, those are the sorts of things that want to be sort of, I think that looking into some form of graphic design blog or lesson from somebody who knows what they're talking about, I think is very useful when considering putting together your sort of your quick reference user interface sheets. There are
I think one of the principles there is that, because I've seen this a couple of times, like the way that you present the information in the rules text as far as possible, you want to retranslate and potentially exactly represent the way that it's presented in the quick reference. So a good example of this actually was I was reading through Old School Essentials, which is like a D&D rulebook, and I got to a table about the monster reactions, like is the monster friendly or neutral or aggressive, and that table is represented in the sort of inner leaf of the back page of the book exactly the same. It's laid out exactly the same, it's exactly the same shape, it's got exactly the same font sizes and everything. And so I don't have to like mentally process that. It's just like, oh, that thing that I want is exactly there. And it happens to be in two places, which I'm back to our rule book hair pulling conversation. Like, I'm beginning to wonder if like just exactly representing information in several places isn't just a terrible idea, because if I want to know how to cast a spell, I probably want to know it in the magic section, and I probably don't mind seeing it next to the spell list, and I definitely want to see it at the back of the book if it's got anything funky about it.
Yeah, and when we do have the rule book conversation, there is a conversation about presenting for reference and presenting for learning. But I think in relation to the sort of user interface visual presentation of quick reference sheets, and that you want to use the sort of graphical layout and table layout that you used in the rules to help trigger people's memory of when they did read the rules, your quick reference sheet is an attempt to be familiar and refamiliarize the player with some rote learning that they did. And so using the same shapes and the same word structures and the same phrases as much as you possibly can in the main rule book is a helpful way of reinforcing that. I think a temptation is to like cut down the bit you wrote in the rule book to this super terse, like cut out every possible word you can.
But that's what I do.
If you use certain phrases at various points, you can sort of train players to remember, this is what they're doing when they're laying out the area effect rules, or they use that phrase whenever they're doing the close combat rules. Okay, I'm back on familiar territory. And I say that because I feel like the place where you want to go a little bit sort of outside of what you've already done is if you've got like an army roster sheet or a character sheet or something of that nature. And I'm of the opinion that the army sheet, if you can, the character quick reference sheet, if you're having one, is a bit more of like guidance about where the player should be looking in the game. You can use those to sort of guide them about, oh, what's the game about? You should know what the game is about, but like, if the game is about, you know, picking up treasure chests, and you have a character sheet with a picture of a like mostly empty treasure chest, and you shade off like levels of the chest as it fills up, you're hooking into a whole bunch of like psychological effects where people want to fill up the treasure chest, and as it gets towards the top, people are going to work harder to get that last little bit. In the games, you can fuel your game by the way that you tweak the user interface of the bit of paper that they're meant to be scribbling on and drawing on and using, in the way that the quick reference sheet is a sort of don't touch that. That's a sacrosanct thing. The fact that you
that's have laminated, yeah.
That's absolutely that's sort of untouchable. The fact that we often have these sheets you're meant to rip out and photocopy and draw on gives you the opportunity to play a little bit with a visual user interface that can help guide players and can like help them to push the momentum of the game at the right moments. You know, if things are getting marked off the character sheet, filled in, you can see that the game's getting to a certain point where the thing's mostly filled in, and people will naturally react to that. They'll naturally get faster, they'll naturally try harder, you know, is these psychological effects sort of push them on those roads. So I think there are things you can leverage with that. So let's
talk about that, because I think we're moving into the visual UI. I think that's a super interesting thing, is that like, I feel like my gaming career in the 90s began with two things, role-playing games and GW games. And one of the things that those two things had in common was basically photocopyable character sheets. So like I've still got my Necromunda gang sheets and my Blood Bowl team sheets, just the same way that I've still got my, you know, my photocopied sort of, you know, Vampire the Masquerade and Warhammer Fantasy roleplay character sheets. So in a role-playing game, it's very, very natural to assume that you're going to photocopy a blank black and white piece of paper and you're going to take a pen or a pencil to it, and it's going to be your scratch pad to like color things in and scratch things out, and you'll be, it's a living document. And I think it's interesting, it's noteworthy that most games over the last 10 years that are miniature games have not provided a similar sort of disposable photocopy interface. And I sort of don't know why, and it's slightly frustrating in many cases because it would be easier if they did. So with Gaslands, I provided these like black and white printoutable cards for each of the cars because I really like this idea of you get a thing that you can scribble all over, and recording damage can be done by crossing off boxes, you know, like we used to do in Battletech, and, you know, stashing, you know, currencies and status effects can happen right there on the card, like we used to do in Manowar. And like, I just like the fact that all of the sort of game stuff is contained, but it's not contained in a laminated sort of pristine, what's the word? Like, it's not a protected thing. It's like, it's mine and it's disposable and I'll use as many as I need. And, you know, I sort of wish that, you know, I'd made a kind of out of Hero Quest character sheet sort of things for Gaslands. Like that would have been a great thing to have. So I think like my first sort of like specific point out of this conversation is really, really think that it's worth thinking about disposable, printable, black and white RPG character sheet style interface for your war game, because why can't you just have an army roster sheet and fill in the stat lines for your, like, why do I have to keep looking at the back of the book or looking at the different sections? Why can't I write things down? A lot of army list builders exist now that will allow you to sort of poop out a little simplified version of that. And in some cases, they'll get very detailed. But it's like, well, why, if that's like critical information that I'm going to need to look up, and it's quite unlikely I'm going to remember, I might remember all 100 of my stats, but I'm not going to remember every 100 number of the 100 numbers on your side of the table. Mm. And just knowing the unit name only allows me to open the book and look it up. It doesn't let me
sit
right there in front of me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the thing is that once you've got that sheet, the sort of, you can reference the way that players are meant to interact with that sheet during the game. You can tell them to cross things off, fill things in, stack a dice here, put a token there. You know, I mean, like with Gaslands, one of the things I find with, like, when demoing it that's really handy is having the gearbox into which you put your gear dice and you turn your gear dice over as it goes along. It's a tactile reminder that the gear is quite an important feature.
Yeah, it's right there, bang in the middle of your character sheet.
And it's a 3D thing you have to physically pick up and look at and turn over. And that gives it a little sort of like, oh, right, okay, this is a little different from certain other things. And drop
yeah, it. And so I captured on that idea, that sort of like prominence with the A Billion Suns sort of little tactical board, which is broadly speaking stolen from Saga, but I'll get back to Saga in a minute. But like similarly, there's a number that you have to track, which is the number of credits that you've got. And I tried loads of user interfaces for this. Like I tried sort of up and down tracks. I tried different kinds of ways of like using dice, using tokens, using numbers, using checkboxes. But what ended up speaking to me, what I ended up doing naturally when I didn't have enough table space was using a D100, because I just know about a D100. And so what I then did was create a little outline of a D100. And I was like, oh, well, naturally I can just pop my D100 into this little silhouette that is begging for a D100 to be sat on it. But then, as you say, it's a 3D object that springs up out of the board. It has the disadvantage that it's a bit nudgeable. But so does pretty much every other potential option here, other than writing things down and then rubbing them out, which is just a little bit too fiddly for my preference. Or didn't, like, you can do that. Everyone knows how to write a number out and cross it out. That wasn't a piece of UI that was necessarily, I mean, but, you know, there's perfectly good treasure gold boxes that are just a big heavy line that says gold colon. And you're like, well, I know what to do here.
I do one of the funny things about using dice for notation is that there's something ever so slightly transgressive about turning a dice to a certain number and setting on that number instead of rolling it. It's a tiny thing, but it's like when I say to people, like I say, when I'm demoing a game to people who are strangers to Castlands, I tell them to turn the dice to that certain number. That's the thing I have to tell people a couple of times to do. People will pick the dice up and roll it to try and find out what their gear is now, because that's what you do with dice. And it's a lovely thing that by breaking that little rule about how dice work, you give a double underline to what I'm doing with that dice at the moment. It's a little bit different. It's not totally sort of innovative, but it just gives a little underline because I've snapped a little mental chain for you, and you go, right, that moment was sort of important in a way that I think that if you slid a little token up and down a counting chart, that wouldn't be the same thing, because that's so sort of ingrained in the way that we do these things.
And with that, we'll take a quick break.
I've been working on a game called Pacific Command, which I talked about a little bit on the Man Battle Stations podcast, if you want to go and check out Man Battle Stations, episode 81. I'm happy doing a mild criticism of Saga, because Glenn has talked at length about how much we like that game.
It is a special game.
And we don't like to poo-poo on other games, but it's often useful to talk about some of the observations about other games if you're going to, you know, learn things and be critical about them. We tend to focus on our own games. But anyway, all of that preamble aside, one of the things that I found recently playing Saga Age of Magic, and I have played Saga a few times, like 3-4 years ago, but the game wasn't super familiar to me. I was learning the second edition. There's quite a lot of new rules or additional rules in Age of Magic that I was also trying to learn at the same time. And what I found in that game is that I was flipping around the rule book quite a lot for some pretty, what seems to me, basic information. And I had to keep looking up the same couple of things, like what is the basic stats for a couple of the odder, newer types of units? And what does these two special rules do? And why aren't they listed in the special rules section? And why isn't the special rules section in alphabetical order? Because I keep losing one of the rules because it starts with a B, but it's buried on the like 14th sort of entry in this list of rules. And it's noteworthy to me is that I think Saga represents fundamentally one of the best user experiences in miniature war games, which is the battle board, which is a incredibly lovely combination of tactile, mental and visual UI that just does this tremendous job of like explaining the core loop of the game and getting you to interface and interact with it in this really physical and sort of direct way. But it doesn't have like unit cards or even a decent quick reference table for the unit stats. And it doesn't provide me any way of like assembling my army in a way that becomes like this really easy to look at reference sheet where I don't lose all of the numbers. And so what I ended up was, even though it's got this beautiful UI, I actually came away from the game being a bit frustrated because the experience was that I had to keep flicking through the rule book. And I get that criticism a lot about flicking through rule books. And I hate that criticism because I know that I can do better. I just don't know how to do better with the rule book. Recently I was messing around with Pacific Command and trying to come up with a sort of A5 sheet that will summarize. In this game, you'll basically have 3, 4, 5 units. They're called task forces and they're quite complicated units. Like think about a Titan or a mech in Battletech. Like those are quite complicated things with lots of weapon systems and lots of damage and lots of all these kinds of little subsystems going on. And I like that. And because that's a complicated thing, like those tend to have a user interface contained on a fairly chunky card. And I think as an aside, it's quite interesting when you go back and look at Manowar and you find the size of the cards is about the same size as a Titan or a mech in Battletech. And it absolutely didn't need to be. It could probably have been a tiny little playing card size. And in fact, you could probably get 3 ships of the line on a single card, but they just went really big. So user interface error there, but it was the early 90s. We can forgive them that.
I like the space. I like the space to operate.
No, I get it. But like in that case, like putting a little fire, putting a fairly reasonably sized fire token on a location could have been a red dot with a pen or a check in a box. So I was working on this sort of task force reference card for Pacific Command and realizing that if I built something in like a spreadsheet, I could get it so that you could sort of populate the weapon systems or the other ships that are in the system, and then it would populate the stats and it would even add up some stats where I'm creating a slightly complicated sort of the attack dice you roll is the sum of the weapon systems, which are basically the ships in your task force, and thinking how nice it would be to make this like there's a sort of complicated setup during army building where I'm choosing this stuff, but that the result of that is that I just write down some simple numbers onto a piece of cardboard, a piece of paper, and that that becomes a really simple thing to interact with on the table, such that, you know, checking off damage or checking off blown up ships sort of makes it obvious when things are changing or what numbers need to affect. So I think that the question of like unit cards and army rosters seems to me under considered.
You were talking about playing a billion suns and physically what you wanted to do to note credits and things. And I think it's a significant point to say, and we'll have a conversation, I'm intending us to have a conversation about physically prototyping, but I think it's relevant to say physically prototype early, get to the tabletop early and see what you're missing when you sort of stand there and start interacting with the game. See where you want to put tokens and dice. See like when you're, I've got to remember this number, what do I do? Well, I'm picking up a dice and I'm putting it there. Okay, I mean, that's what I want to do. That's maybe what I should interact with. It's like the game I'm working on at the moment, Pukepocalypse, where we had a very early test game, and I wanted the puke tokens to be like on the table, and Mike was immediately, I'm putting them on my character sheet, I don't want them on the table. And it's like, yeah, that was right, you know, they should be there at this point and then they should be on the table at that point. And sort of
right, they're in my tummy, so they're on my character sheet, they're thrown up on you and all over the ground, so they're on the table.
Yeah, and sort of as the sooner you physically get things onto the tabletop and the sooner you start realizing that it feels very different when you write down where to put something and how to operate it from when you actually do it. And you want to try and find the intuitive ways of sort of physically operating things on the tabletop, because those are the ways that they're going to most easily remind people and they're going to interact with most sort of effortlessly. So yeah, I think sort of early prototyping, early sort of physically getting onto the tabletop. I think it's funny sort of you mentioning Saga there, because I think that Saga is an example of a game that was written for learning rather than referencing, and also a game that sort of they haven't gone back and reconsidered that as they've added in sort of more and more stuff. Because it's like, of course they aren't super paying attention to the like units for quick reference card, because originally there were three units and they had like, you know, two or three stats each. Nobody needed a quick reference system for that, you know. But literally by the end of my first game, I already had in my head the way those three units worked. And then, you know, we got a few more characters added in, and then a few more bits added in, and a few more special rules added in. And by the time you get to Age of Magic, you've got quite a few units and quite a few rules.
And it's still a pleasingly simple game, and it's very simple for what it's trying to achieve. It's just that it's now crossed over the path into, yeah, I probably need to just see all this information in one place so that I don't have to flip around.
Well, I think it's such a popular game and one that sort of gets people and keeps them to fans for so long, that what's happened is that every sort of 6 to 12 months, your mate has wandered over and gone, oh, there's one additional unit. You remember, you're remembering three, remember a fourth one. Well, that's fine. I've got those three engraved on my skull at this point. A fourth one's no problem. And then they've done it again. And then a new person wanders in and it's like, okay, we just have to memorize these 12 things. Like, you know, and it's like, reconsider maybe as things. And I think this is why one of the many reasons, and there are many reasons, it's super important to like do blind playtesting whenever you can with your game, because you have every part of your game is like engraved on your heart. It's branded onto you. It's as natural as breathing, the sort of the 27 different unit types that have 15 different actions each. Like, well, obviously it's unit 18B and it's 37th action. Why would you even struggle to remember this? Because you've built it up by drips all the way through. And when you present that to a total stranger, you know, I sometimes pick up rule sets, you know, from the sort of in development, and I look at them, I'm just like, oh God, I mean, I'm quite good at rule sets, but this is terrifying. I don't want to touch this. It's too much, you know, and find a way to guide me through that sort of.
Well, and I think that's one of the things where like character sheet style, like, you know, a warband roster or whatever, is quite nice, because the act of transcribing for some people will again, like, lock in certain things or provide a kind of, you know, a trigger for memory, and also like can provide then, you know, the fact that I've kind of boiled down from all the possible rules complexity, I've sort of said, this is the BART that I will look at. I'm just going to box off this stuff that I need to know about, and I'm not going to worry about the giant mess of everything else. I just grabbed something off my shelf to double check, because I seemed to remember it and kind of confirmed it. So one place that I think is a good example of this is in Frostgrave. So Frostgrave has got a couple things that it's got like three areas that are quite complicated, but they're all, you get like photocopyable stuff, UI in the book for all of these things, like the wizard and the apprentice and all the things that happen to them through the campaign is important. And the book provides a wizard sheet with all the stuff that you'd kind of, it looks like an RPG character sheet. Like it's got, you know, it's got things about like what's in your home base and what's in your treasury and which, you know, magic items have you got and so forth. And then there's a separate set of things for writing down all the soldiers and gang members that you've hired. But then critically, because obviously the first time you try and build a wizard, you're like, oh my God, there are so many spells. How am I going to do this? Critically, he also provides not very beautiful, but incredibly functional, magic card, so that every spell has got a little card that you can print out, and then choosing your spells is as easy as cutting these out with a pair of scissors and choosing the ones that you want. And so like everything that you need to play the game in Frostgrave is sort of thrown at you, and with a pencil you then go and, okay, so it's gonna, you know, I'll write down the stats for the ranger and I'll write down the stats for the barbarian and so forth, and that kind of helps you ring fence the rules that you need to worry about, and then also provides you with this way of looking at it that's super game usable.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think so, yeah, so they're talking about, you know, cards, and I think there's a significant difference again, I think, between a quick reference sheet or quick reference page in a book and a quick reference card. So, you know, you'll often want the spells, for example, you know, in a game, to be on a card to be able to pick up and look at. You might sort of have taken a few spells out of the lore in a way that you don't really want the specific spells you're casting to be on a quick reference sheet. You want the method of casting to be on a quick reference sheet, and you want whatever happens when,
right,
you
and there's a tactile element, yeah, to isolating that, because then I can put it next to the model that cast it or is carrying the spell, or I can put it on the target that it's going to, yeah, you know, to remind myself that it's got, you know, feet of strength for the next one turn or whatever. Yeah, so that, like, that affordance of, do I need, is the position of this piece of information important or not?
Yeah,
like, for a long time in Hobgoblin, I wanted Hobgoblin to have some historicals have this, like, I wanted Hobgoblin to have little fillable cards where, like, I can put the card behind the unit and it says the thing, it has there to hit row, and it has like, you know, place for you can to write their things in. I may still do that before the end of the print run, but like the point being that, like, there's a tiny unit card and I want it to be near the unit that it is, which is kind of strange, because like most time I actually have unit cards, I array them off the table so that I've got quick reference for them, which might be the reason that I haven't done this. Other people in some historicals have done it where they poke out from underneath and they expect you to write it down on like the edge of it and then slide it under the unit, which is quite, yeah, nice.
Yeah, and I think one of the interesting things, I think, again, one of the things about cards being sort of more natural to pick up and hold, this is something I've noticed a few times, is that you get your, you usually get your spells on sort of reference cards, because you want to pick them up and you want to mutter and consider them as you're looking at the tabletop, because these are your options. They belong to you and you get to choose how to interact with them. Whereas whenever somebody picks up the quick reference sheet and looks very closely at it while muttering and looking at the table, I feel like I have the right to go,
those are shared rules. There oughtn't to be anything in there that's surprising.
Yeah, you shouldn't be looking that closely and thinking about something. And I do think that's a very real thing, is that, you know, the tactile nature of cards, of reference cards, tell you that this is something that you can pick up, you can own as your bit of the game, which is very different to a quick reference sheet. If a lore of magic is written on a page of a rule book, it feels like it should sit on the tabletop open and people should be able to look at it. If it's printed on some cards, it feels like you should be able to pick them up and you know, and I think that the tactile nature of the way that people interact with the bits of your user interface are super sort of educational, as it were. You need to sort of think about how we deal with things. We hold cards in a very specific way. We fan them in a certain way. We want to keep them face down. It's like you can give people reference cards that have open information and they will put them face down. You know, that everybody knows what's on that card. You show the other person what's on that card and they will naturally just pop it face down. You're like, but that's to remind you of something. It's really inconvenient putting it face down. It's just hardwired into you that you've got your card. It goes face down and other people don't see it. And playing with those things and sort of tweaking them. And I think it's why, like, so in relation to the tactile sort of bits of the game, the dice, the cards, the tokens, is when you're deciding whether something should maybe be done with a card or maybe should be done with a dice, think a little bit about how people normally interact with that object. Think about the sorts of behaviours you're leveraging with them and what they want to do with it. Apart from the sheer convenience of it, of like, you know, if I'm doing a wound counter, I want it to be a dice because the numbers are already there, whereas I don't want to do it with a card because I have to take that card out and put a new one in. But think about like what people want to do with dice when they pick them up. Think about what people want to do with cards when they pick them up. Think about what people think about tokens. Tokens operate in a very different way. Tokens are meant to be dropped onto the table, you know, next to the miniature. They're meant to note things. They're meant to sit on reference.
Well, and so I think like that I think gets us into one of the interesting elements that I think quite often the tactile UI doesn't, not everyone like completely answers this question in their game designs, and I'm not certain that I always do either, but like, what part of the UI is your responsibility as the game designer to provide, and which parts is it just okay to say, and you need this to track this thing or the location of this thing or the number of these things? Because like going back to Frostgrave, it makes some really interesting and I think quite deliberate decisions on this topic, where like there's a couple of things, tactile things in the game that you absolutely need. Like you need treasure tokens. The game does not function without treasure tokens, but there aren't a little set of treasure tokens to cut out in the back of the book, even though there's loads of other things in the back of the book to cut, stick and mend and make. And I think that's because Joe's saying, no, treasure tokens are cool and fun models that you should worry about as much as you should worry about the wizard in your warband. Go to town, have a good time, but you will need to make them. Whereas, like, Joe also says, and I'm not sure everyone does this, but like Joe says, use a pencil and an eraser to track wounds on all of your models. Don't put dice on the table. And he does that by providing a quick reference sheet for all your soldiers, which has a box that says current wounds in it. So you literally get a space in the UI to write down something that otherwise you'd have had to provide a solution for. And I'm sure everybody tracks it in different ways. I use dice and count down, and so, you know, other people will do all kinds of other things and so forth. But the point is, there, a specific and deliberate decision has been made about what UI component is your responsibility as the player versus provided by the games designer, as opposed to something like Malifaux, which has this really, really sort of honking problem in the middle of it, which is it has a ton of status effects that provide absolutely no guidance about how to track them, and created this whole like cottage industry of laser cut token printing, because there were just way too many of them. And you had poison and fire, and all kinds of different special ones for each master and so forth. And that's interesting as well, because the game provides these beautiful laminated, shiny gloss cards that has all the rules that you need, and it's beautifully laid out. And they've been incredibly thoughtful about the fact that on your turn, the passive effects are on one side of the card, and when it's the other person's turn, you turn it over, and all the active effects on it. It's absolutely incredibly thought out, and you can, you know, dot the wound counts along on the front of it. And yet there's this huge blind side about the fact that, like, you get to the table and the first thing you do is you choose your missions, and it's like, okay, I've got to lay a bunch of tokens out for this, that, and the other. Where are they? Oh crap, like, I'm stuck. Okay, right, now we have to, like, do some poison and death, and, like, how do I track that? Well, there's not even a space on the card to write the damn effect on. Like, it's really interesting. I'm not necessarily throwing shade there. I'm just saying, like, this question of what is your responsibility to at least provide an idea of what the intended user interface for tracking or registering it is, I think, is really worth thinking about, because a lot of games skim over it, and it ends up costing mental overhead and friction at the table, where you could have just provided an answer.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's one thing where you're whatever, a Malifaux or a guild board, where there is going to be a cottage industry of people who provide very lovely bespoke solutions to these problems. But if you're not, and there aren't people who are getting, like, status rings for your game, people to drop around their miniatures, then you're really giving people a hard time to sort of deal with some of this stuff. I mean, I remember when I sort of picked up a Guild Ball team, and it was like, oh, you'll also need these tokens and counters and cards and widgets and things. And absolutely have my heart sort of drop through my shoes on that. It just makes me feel like, I don't think maybe this is a game for me. I tell you—
Right, whereas you could have maybe just had a little piece of paper that you printed and cut out, and every time you played a game, you maybe printed another one. Black and white character sheets for the win.
I tell you one thing that I've been using recently that I think should just be in everything is a measuring widget. I made a sort of measuring widget for one of the games I'm testing, and every time I go to measure anything while I'm playtesting Puke Apocalypse, I'm just picking up that widget because it's just infinitely better than
it. Is it a 1-2-3-inch widget?
It's in this particular case, it's 4-3-2-1 going around it. And I think this is an interesting one, because it's like, you sometimes throw in numbers for distances as you're writing, just like 8 inches sounds about right, 6 is probably okay, 4, I don't know, 3 maybe, and stopping and going, okay, right, well, maybe I'd like to give people, like, a measuring tool. Should I sort of consider holding myself to certain bands of measurement, and going, you know, well, look, I've got a whole bunch of 3 and 4 inches. Does it matter if they're all just 4 inches, or should this 8-inch be 6 inches? And I think it's worth—
Right, and the answer to that is definitely not obvious, because, you know, part of the wonder of these non-discrete games is the fact that you can create all kinds of wonderful scenarios. And so having models that move different things does create that sort of spectrum.
Well, we always have the option of up to
4 inches
on a measuring widget, but it is sort of like, you know, what are the upper limits of our up to that we're setting? And if I've arbitrarily put in 6, 7, and 8 inches, where 6 and 8 inches would do. And similarly, I think in reference to the sort of the tracking of statuses in things like Malifaux, I think there is an opportunity at some point for somebody somewhere to go, do we really need all of these statuses, guys? I mean, look at, these are the tokens that we need to track. If I had all of the statuses running in a given game, this is, and it was the end of second edition. I was already at the point of like, oh my, you could legitimately have like 9 different tokens noting the entirely different state all on the tabletop at one time. That's too many. Somebody somewhere should have gone, guys, let's say 6. 6 is the most beyond that. And I think it's also, one of the things about tokens and counters and such like, which is a sort of something to think about and make a decision about, is do they get put on the table, or do they get put on character cards or something off to one side?
Yeah.
Why do you want people to put them? What will the table look like if they do the thing you didn't want them to do? Because it's it, and I think people have different points of view. Some people love a clean tabletop with no tokens on them. Some people like to be able to read the state of the table at a glance. I much prefer to be able to read the table at a glance. I think
that's an interesting point just to catch on and double underline, because I think one of the things that people initially assume is a clear table is an elegantly designed game. And I don't know that that's necessarily true. Like, it's not necessarily the case that your design goal should be a pristine table that's completely free from non-diegetic information and elements, and the only thing that should be on the table is scale models interacting with scale terrain. Because, as you say, like, some people just like to look at a table and go, it's got three wounds left. That's important. I don't want that hidden over there. That piece of information is absolutely critical to every decision I make with regard to that unit.
Yeah. And I think it's one of these things where, like, models are one of the potentially a big user interface piece to these games. If you've got a table full of single wound models, you can instantly tell which things have been wounded because they get taken off once they're wounded. It's very intuitive. It gives a lot of information. On a slight side note, there's a Kickstarter that I just love the idea of, thing called I Am Ronin, which is totally based on the idea of 3D printing. And in that, your samurai has different stances through combat, and when he moves to his next stance, which gives him different bonuses and abilities, you switch the mini out for the different one in the different stance.
Outrageous.
And I've mentioned it on the Roundup channel, because I love that somebody's done that, and it's like, I don't know if it's super effective, but I want that to be. I want that to exist. I want more.
Right. Asking the question, do you want to play this game well enough to paint the same model five times so that you can play it fully painted? Listen, I feel like there's probably another conversation in miniatures as UI and all the things that emerge from that, that I'm kind of surprised we haven't already covered. We should put that on the backlog.
We have touched on it. I think we've touched on the majority, I think, of the user interface points in these two conversations for now. Unless there's something specific you'd like to hit on before we round up?
No, I think that's it. More printable black and white user interfaces for armies and characters and so forth.
Take serious consideration about what it is like to interact with your game, where information is noted, how people have the information presented to them. Read some graphic design books or blogs if you're not already sort of educated in that area. It's super useful. Make efforts and pains to give people what they need to play your game. That shouldn't be that shouldn't need citation. That should be like, well, yeah, obvs. I know we live in a sort of make do and mend sort of area of things where people are expected to get together the dice and get together the tokens, but think about how they're going to do that. Think about how to ease it for them, and think about how to tell them what to get together and how, don't just say note things with a token. Tell them what sort of token. Tell them why it's significant that it's that sort of token. Give people the tools they need to play your game. If there is a tactile element of a game, we've mentioned, games that have too many counters. What's the exact right number of counters? Which game had the exact right number of counters? What was exactly right?
Oh, Glenn, I didn't even get a chance to rant about Conan, the board game with the little fatigue system with the three boxes that you move gems between. Oh, that's an incredible system for tracking miniature things.
What is your favorite system for tracking information in a game? How is it done? Did they do it in a tactile sort of element of things? The Frostgrave boxes make me think of the stamina boxes in Fighting Fantasy books. And that's why I like them. What will your user interface reference? What's your favorite reference or callback within a user interface? That there's some little Easter eggs you've enjoyed while playing a game and thought, I know what he wants me to think of at this point.
How many hit boxes for a mech's torso is the correct number?
Drop down to the comments section and give us your answer to these questions and more. Run over to the Discord while you're doing it and bellow these numbers at me without context and then run away again. hit the like and subscribe buttons.
Oh, please do. We need to feed the algorithm.
The algorithm is hungry.
We need to hear your voice.
It's so...
Stand up and be counted. Press the like button.
It's so nearly sated. So nearly sated. But for now, it's going to be a thank you and a goodbye from this episode of Rule of Carnage. So we'll say thank you and goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Ciao. Bye.